Welcome to Focus on Education, a podcast from the Center for Educational Practice at Union University's School of Education.
Today is January 31st, 2013, and this is Eric Marvin. Today's podcast focuses on the topic of technology in higher education and shares thoughts of several Union faculty members during a recent faculty workshop. We will begin with the keynote address of Dr. Tom Roseborough, followed by a panel discussion about technology in education, which includes professors from various disciplines at Union. Here is Dr. Roseborough's address.
All right. Well, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to be the lead-in for this panel this morning and to talk about teaching and change. Change can be sudden, as we know, like snapping on a bright light, or it can creep incrementally, like a spreading smile or frown on a young child's face. The result of change is often a mix of fear and exhilaration. With online education, certainly comes the realization that something is different here. How are we to respond as a great teaching university? At Union, where we educate the head and the heart, we wonder if online learning will diminish our face-to-face community. Nonetheless, change is happening. Stanford, Michigan, MIT, Penn, Princeton, Yale, and Carnegie Mellon are moving aggressively online, giving millions of students access to some of the world's best teachers through an ironically awkward acronym called MOOC, Massively Open Online Courses. At Duke University, business students use a state-of-the-art virtual lecture hall to have conversations with CEOs and fellow students from around the world. At Harvard, the flipped model is replacing the traditional lecture model. This may be bad news for many professors who cannot sleep at night because they cannot wait to get up in the morning to hear what they're going to say. And no, I didn't sleep well last night. The lecture method was born in the halls of higher education and has been sustained there, even today, when students are able to access just about any piece of information on the internet. Higher education has always tended to teach to what instead of who. I am concerned that the information age is radically magnifying our tendency to think that teaching, despite all evidence to the contrary, is about pouring the tenets of our academic disciplines into students' heads. I desire a new transformational focus on why we teach and who we teach, which has implications on how we teach. I am convinced that online innovations can help us learn to be better teachers, not only online, but also in face-to-face classrooms. But I want to get beyond the adolescence of dazzlement to real adult learning. Frequently now, online educators are paying attention to good pedagogy, and optimism is justified amidst our doubts. After all, good online teachers can tailor learning experiences to students' individual pace and interest. Wonderful audio and video opportunities are at learners' fingertips. Professors can guide reading and writing for their students. The dominant mode of expression online is writing, and the act of writing down our thoughts usually trumps vocalizing them in terms of deep understanding and learning. Think of it. Union University now has a platform to the world. Much can be learned as we experiment with the wedding of good pedagogy with technology. But before I ring any wedding bells, I will express my doubt this way. We can simulate great face-to-face classroom teaching online, but we cannot duplicate it. My doubt is founded upon the complexity of holistic classroom teaching. Connecting, collaborating, and communicating seem to be among the top buzzwords in discussion about teaching in the 21st century. Clearly, our students are conditioned to think about communication in new ways. Jeremy in the cartoon Zits recently was on the phone with a service representative saying, "No offense, ma'am, but could you just connect me to the automated system?" Students are accepting this culture as good and sufficient. One question is whether teachers will do the same. But another question is, when given a choice in education, will students choose convenience and control over personalization and depth? Several years ago, Dr. Dockery screened with his cabinet the movie Apollo 13 as a way of brainstorming about problem solving at the university. The first evening of the new year, I saw the film again. I was re-inspired. If you recall, Apollo 13 was commanded by Jim Lovell, played by Tom Hanks, and was supposed to be the third landing on the moon. Something went wrong with a wire in an oxygen tank on the way there. The mission was no longer about the moon, but getting back to Earth. One of the first life and death problems to be solved was literally how to fit a square peg in a round hole. The astronauts risked death because of raised carbon dioxide levels in the spacecraft. With duct tape, plastic bags, and ingenuity, the engineers on the ground in Houston gave the astronauts a procedure to reinvent a device out of materials available on the spacecraft. The Apollo team was forced to focus on the problem and not on guesses about how to solve the problem. Today, we are thinking about teaching in the context of using technology to accomplish learning goals. Some would say that online teaching, as compared to personalized pedagogy, is tantamount to fitting a square peg in a round hole. Well, it might be. I do not think that that is our problem. Our problem, if you will, is the audacious mission of Christ-centered academic excellence. To say it another way, our problem at the university is to stay focused on who. Head and heart animate who we are. Who we are is what poet Stanley Kunitz terms our indestructible essence. Teachers are called to reach and activate the spiritual essence in every learner. The question we must ask is, why do we teach? What really matters in education is not what, but who. The great equation of teaching is why equals who. Great teaching, what we have called transformational teaching, compels students to ask not just, what have I learned, but also, who am I becoming? How do we continue to achieve our mission in an educational culture that seems antithetical to it? Much of teaching begins with an attitude. Apollo 13 flight director Gene Kranz famously corrected a colleague who worried that they were having the worst disaster NASA had ever seen. He said, "With all due respect, gentlemen, I believe this will be our finest hour." At Union, how can we make today our finest hour in teaching? What do we face that is antithetical? We must confront technology itself. By its nature, which is the application of science and the scientific method to education, we see how limited it is. As believers, we know that not all of life lends itself to the experimental worldview. We are just now realizing how revolutionary the digital age is. Other mass communications inventions, like the printing press and television, have had their impact upon education. All three are tools, but none of them have to replace the teacher. All three have brought personal accessibility, but the computer has added a profound customization that can lead to an even greater impact on education. So what are the essentials of teaching? And secondly, how can we embrace technology as a friend for our mission? From a teacher's presentation of content, students must feel or perceive an individual, even personal, connection in learning. And thus, we share a reminder. A principle for all of us is that we have not taught until learning takes place. Teaching is not the same as presenting. The old homily still applies. I taught my dog Fluffy to talk, then why isn't he talking? Because he never learned. Another reminder is this. One of the myths of pedagogy is that tests contribute to the learning process because they show what students have learned. The fact is that exams hold students accountable and give important feedback that reinforces learning. Learning, however, is only demonstrated in the student's ability to apply their new knowledge in different contexts. The transformational pedagogy model in our book depicts the goals of academic, social, and spiritual surrounded by the teacher roles of scholar, practitioner, and relator, with the student in the center of the model. Traditional means of information presentation are hardly the answer to reaching students in any classroom environment, virtual or otherwise. Scholars are confident in their subject. This is bedrock. The roles of practitioner and relator must increasingly come to the fore as we realize that informational teaching is necessary, but not sufficient. We must vary our methods as practitioners. Teacher relators are needed more than ever in a generation that is more connected, yet far apart. Students who are often satisfied with shallow understanding of both their subject and other people. Relators meet social and spiritual goals and have larger purposes in their roles because they are committed to listening and responding to students' true identities. In its essence, teaching is close to parenting. Hence, we recall the Latin phrase from English common law in loco parentis to describe a teacher's role as in the place of parents while children are in school. Like parents, teachers instruct and correct, but in teaching, like life itself, we also listen, laugh, and love. Instruction and correction fit online teaching very well. Listening, laughing, and loving do not translate at a distance so easily. Renowned environmental scientist John Houghton, a believer, shared an insight into God's truly unique creation. What he has created in the natural world has the ability to recreate itself as compared to human invention. Consider the vacuum cleaner or the laptop computer. Neither has the ability to make new vacuum cleaners or new computers. Humans can update their machines, but God makes animals, plants, and stars in the heavens that can make other plants and stars. After comprehending this insight, one of my students said, that the same should be true for our goals for teaching. We as teachers need to allow students to recreate themselves as independent, self-directed learners. This is the goal of transformational teaching. We must focus on inspiring our students to become lifelong learners. Students will learn when teachers place inspiration before information. It was William Butler Yeats who said that education is not the filling of a pail, but the lighting of a fire. Why do students sit in our classes? Why do they come to Union? Dallas Willard asserts that the goal of the teacher in Jesus' time was not to impart information, but to make a significant change in the lives of hearers. And how do we know that our teaching is making a difference in our students? It is not by just the questions we ask, but by the questions our students ask. So it was with our master teacher, Jesus. Recall John chapter 3, verses 1 to 17, where he tells Nicodemus, a very knowledgeable man, that no one can see the kingdom of God unless they are born again. His student Nicodemus then asks, "How can someone be born when they're old?" Jesus goes on to explain about being born in the Spirit. And his student again asks, "How can this be?" "You are Israel's teacher," said Jesus, "and do you not understand these things? I have spoken to you of earthly things, and you do not believe. How then will you believe if I speak of heavenly things?" Nicodemus had paradigmed himself into secular thinking and had to be prodded, even jarred, into thinking about the spiritual dimension. Jesus challenged his student with his teaching. Students need us, and we need them. Transformation is a pedagogical mutuality. Great teachers are still needed. Ideas like flipped classrooms can remind us that students are novices in our academic disciplines and need expert teachers' assistance in learning. Actually, the flipped classroom is an example of what we should have been doing in teaching anyway. As experts in our disciplines, we can place ourselves on a pedagogical continuum and do at least two things for our students. One, we can analyze and organize content through exposition. And two, we can stimulate and guide inquiry through discussion and student research. Here is another principle of pedagogy. Much like fence posts on a fence line, teachers can create more learning with fewer topics by post-holing for depth in content. Allow students to solve problems and answer questions that challenge them, and guide them to use technology to do the research. We need to trust the process of learning and not obsess on products. Learning happens along the way, if we invest ourselves in process, which gives us the byproducts we desire. The process includes the lifelong learning skills our students develop as they answer important questions and solve problems. In transformational teaching, we call them strategic learning qualities: openness, skepticism, civility, persistence, imagination, and curiosity. Their development enables students to be self-directed, independent learners. Choice and control will be paramount for learners in the information age. I believe that students should work harder than their teachers. This creates two positives. One, students will learn deeply and widely. And two, the use of technology will create more work, not less, for teachers. By befriending technology and using good pedagogy, we will create more work and wealth for ourselves at the university. Finally, there is a paradox in teaching. To change learners, we must focus on things we cannot see in order to accomplish the visible achievement goals we value. We are to look inward to what we cannot see. Marie Montessori, perhaps the most effective early childhood educator of all, expressed her famous method as having discovered the world within the soul of the child. The invisible trumps the visible. At Union, our four core values are a kind of invisible, timeless support. Our core values lead us to want to engage our students and more. Even in the middle of a MOOC, engaged learners need to be self-regulated, defining their own learning goals and evaluating their own achievement. They become energized by their learning. Their joy of learning leads to a lifelong ability to solve problems by transferring knowledge to new contexts. We must expect more from the teacher-student dynamic, hold on to what is of value in the past, and use new tools of learning in the future. Let's make this our finest hour at Union University. Thank you.
Dr. Roseborough's keynote address served as a thought-provoking introduction to the workshop panel. Here is the panel discussion about technology in education.
In our faculty development committee, we had a discussion about all this, and you know, people were talking about some of the anxiety over technology, and they were saying they hoped that we could have a kind of an open discussion about technology, that you wouldn't feel like that the university is trying to sell you on something, but rather we're going to have people who will talk about some of the strengths of technology, what it makes possible, but also some of the drawbacks, maybe some of the warnings involved in technology in education. So with that, what we're going to do, I've kind of drawn up a little order. I've tried to kind of juggle people a little bit to mix up the perspectives. So what we're going to do, I'll hold on to one of the mics and I'll prompt people as it's their turn. But our order of presentation is going to be Eric Marvin. So if somebody would pass him a mic. Eric Marvin, then Ashok Phillip, then Ben Mitchell, then Sharon Evans, then Gavin Richardson, Andrew Tiger, and I will finish. And after that, each one will speak for about 5 to 7 minutes. So even our students could handle these short presentations. then after that, we'll open up the floor. We have a couple of mics. If you see, there's one there and one over there on the floor. And after we're done, we would encourage you to, if you have a comment or a question, just to take to one of the mics and air it out. And, you know, if somebody on the panel can respond usefully to a question or comment, then we'll do that. Okay, so with that, why don't we start with Eric Marvin?
What I'd like to begin with this morning is this question about the role of a faculty member at a time when so much content is readily available to our students on the internet. I think as faculty members, we have a very unique role to play as facilitators of learning, and certainly a level of facilitation that is supported by technology and technology use. This idea of facilitation in and of itself is not necessarily something that is new or novel. It is something that has been supported by educational theorists since the work of Vygotsky, of Dewey, of Piaget, and others who are advocates for this idea of constructivist learning. But what is relatively new is the fact that we really do have access to so much content so quickly, and that our students have access to this information as well. And so it is important for us, I believe, as faculty members, when we are sitting down at the beginning of a term and thinking about our syllabi and the assignments that we want to include in our courses, that we are really beginning with that end in mind, thinking about those outcomes that we want to see for our students, and not just in relation to content, but intentionally with technology as well, and how technology can be integrated into these assignments. Because if we're not intentionally doing that, it should not be a surprise come the end of the term that our students have not been engaged in a 21st century approach. But we do realize, I think it's a very foundational idea in terms of technology and technology integration, that technology is a tool. The internet is one of these related tools as well. Cognitive psychologist Daniel Willingham, I think, has addressed this question or this idea rather well. He has indicated that often we as professors, as new technology comes into our classroom, whether it is something that is tangible or intangible, whether it is hardware or software, or even perhaps a Web 2.0 tool, we often are asking that question in our own mind, well, here is this technology, how can I use this technology? And whether it is intentional or not, our focus is then moving to the technology and thinking about the skills training that is perhaps associated with that given technology. But rather what we should be asking is, what outcomes do I want to see for my students? And if we change our perception or change our thoughts in that way, we are then focusing on the related technology tools that will enable our students to reach those designated outcomes. Every technology certainly does have a related function, and it is important for us to gain a level of understanding as to what those functions are. In the same way that a screwdriver or a hammer have intended outcome or intended functions, rather, we must realize that technological tools also have intended functions. And so our job as professors is to identify and focus first on that related content and what it is that we want our students to know or be able to do at the end of the given course, but then also to be able to align to those given strategies, to those given outcomes, related tools that would perhaps be most appropriate for them. Our challenge is to not only help our students learn that content and to build relationships in their understanding of that content, but also to help them engage in that content with more modern tools and their ability to process information and to think in the 21st century. We realize that there is so much information that is available on the web that we do have this responsibility to help them filter through that related content as well. Because just because it is available online, it obviously does not mean that it is accurate information. And so what better way than to help our students engage in that content and filter through that content and make sense of it with someone who is an expert in that field. But we also need to help them relate to the idea of communication and collaboration as effective digital citizens. I think from a Christian perspective as well, we have a unique role to play in that regard, of helping them not only understand what it means to be a citizen of our tangible world, but also to be an effective citizen in this digital environment as well. There is this question that I often pose to my students at the start of my educational technology course. The question is a pencil technology? Now, some of my students initially look at me and think I'm a little bit crazy, and they argue the point. They say, well, a pencil has no way of being a technology. It is, of course, not sold at Best Buy, they argue. But additionally, they say, well, it does not have a circuit board, it does not have batteries, it does not have a power cord, and so no way can it be a technology. But the reality is, if we realize that it is a tool, it really is a form of technology. And the reason I bring this question up is the fact that it demonstrates to us how seamlessly that technology has been integrated into classrooms. We don't think twice about using pencils. There are no special laboratories, no special training for the use of that type of technology or that type of tool in our classroom. And I think that we should be perhaps dreaming for that day when more modern technologies, more cutting-edge technologies are engaged or are integrated into our classrooms in such an authentic, seamless way. I fear, though, that we will not necessarily reach that goal of true integration if we desire to maintain a level of tradition in higher education. If we are stuck in our traditional strategies and our traditional approaches, we perhaps will never reach that ultimate goal of true integration in that regard. There's plenty of people out there in our culture who would perhaps like to label us as professors who are out of touch, alignment with technology and how information can be shared and distributed. And they are looking for more transparent, more authentic ways to be engaged with the content. And it is why perhaps they are turning to newer technologies such as MOOCs and the ability to be able to obtain that information and that content completely free of charge and in a shared community online. And so it is perhaps challenging the tradition of what higher education is all about.
Thank you. If you would pass down to Ashok, maybe if we can do so without disturbing our placards. Okay, to you, Ashok.
Good morning, everybody. My thoughts on technology are primarily influenced by our collective goal at Union, which is to pursue excellence in teaching. And the way I interpret it is that we are working hard to achieve truly student learning in the class. That's the goal, and that's the basis for my thoughts on technology. And the disclaimer is I'm going to use technology loosely in a global sense and not one form of technology. Technology in its entirety is what my intention is to use it. So my first thought on technology is that, to me, technology, if used alone, is mostly or most of the time informative in nature. And from a student perspective, what that means is it encourages them to memorize, and the more dangerous thing is information storage. So if we take the teacher out of the context of a teacher-student interaction, then technology is mostly or most of the time informative in nature. Takes the student and it forces the student to memorize and to store information. That's what they would start to rely on. And there's several different styles of student learning. There's the visual learners. There's the ones who like interactive learning. So no matter how different styles of learning that the student relies on, if we take the teacher out of the context, which I call it the human element, then I agree with Dr. Roseborough, then technology only simulates a teaching environment. It does not recreate, it does not recreate a learning experience. So it doesn't matter what kind of styles the student relies on, technology without the teacher only simulates, but I think Dr. Roseborough used the term, does not duplicate, and I agree with that completely. And the other element is just because we've taken the teacher out of the context, it becomes extremely difficult to communicate the teacher's passion for their subject area through technology alone. And more importantly, that I think is the teacher now cannot teach from a personal experience perspective, a point of view that a teacher can present in the classroom to the students one-on-one in real time if the focus is on relying completely on technology, if we take the teacher out of the context again. And my major concern to using, to technology, again, I'm using it in a global sense, my major concern to technology currently is that the fact that, it is a fact now, that students now have started to believe that technology replaces learning, that technology actually replaces the need to learn, that they could rely on technology alone and there's no need for them to learn, which is in direct contradiction to our goal at Union, which is to achieve significant learning in the classroom. Not outside the classroom, outside too, but in the classroom. So those are my thoughts on, a little bit, initial thoughts on technology. Now, having said that, I'm not against technology. I'm actually pro-technology. I think, hard to believe after everything I said, but technology is good if used appropriately to facilitate teaching and student learning in the class. So the keyword is if used appropriately to facilitate teaching in the class. So having said that, if you're a bad teacher, humor aside,
LOL.
I'll rephrase it. If you're not a good teacher, I recommend embracing technology to facilitate teaching and student learning in the class. More importantly, there's one great value I see in technology is that it takes us away from this information dumping. Again, Dr. Roseberg uses the word dumping. It takes us away from that. It's a bad thing. It takes us away from this information dumping, which I believe is a unidirectional way of passing on information from the teacher to the student and leave it at that. So it takes us away from this information dumping, and now we can start to challenge students in real time in the class. We can engage students in the class. We can force them to think critically in the class if technology is used appropriately. And there's so many examples that you could use of how technology works, especially in pharmacy. We use it to great value in patient simulation, so they could experience the real clinical scenario within their curriculum in the School of Pharmacy. So to finish off, I would say use technology to facilitate learning. Don't use it to replace learning.
Thank you, Ashok. With that, we'll go to Ben Mitchell.
Thank you. My own disclaimers. First of all, I want to talk specifically about technology as a means of delivery of education. Seems to me, and it's just transparent to all of us, I'm sure, that you can't meaningfully teach in the 21st century engineering, biology, pharmacy without the utilization of some technology. But we're talking about technology as a means of delivery in education. A couple of bona fides. My Bachelor of Science degree was in educational psychology from a little land-grant institution in East Central Mississippi you might have heard of. And I was taught there, if not the first day of class, at least the first semester of one of my Bachelor of Science educational psychology classes, that just as we have said, education is not just information dump. It's not just information transfer. There's more that has to go on for what we do in the classroom to be described effectively as education. I should also say I've taught in the modular context. I've taught, of course, the traditional context. And I teach regularly some online courses. And I use technology regularly in the classroom. Having said that, like Ashok, I want to say something contrary, or what may sound contrary to that is that I'm technologically Amish. That is to say, the Amish are not anti-technology. I was looking at Tom's picture of the post holes or the fences with post holes up there. The Amish don't dig post holes with their bare hands. Rather, they use technologies like shovels and other kinds of technology. But the Amish have a form of life that they believe contributes to human flourishing and cultivates the goods that they believe are important to that form of life, to that way of life. And I believe there's a form of life that we cultivate in the classroom, and I hope that that form of life contributes to human flourishing. And so I want to evaluate each technology to ask whether or not it contributes to that form of life, whether or not it contributes to that telos, that end of human existence, or does it in fact distract from or detract from that form of life. I'm a Christian personalist, and personalist anthropology holds that there's a priority to the incarnated, embodied human person. And that's to the question that Tom has raised in his initial talk about the who. I think the most important thing about teaching and learning are the whos, the teacher and the learner. And often that is indeed flipped because I learn, like you, I learn as much in teaching often as my students, sadly sometimes more than they do. Technologies, therefore, should not supplant the human person or replace the embodied human experience, but contribute to it in meaningful ways. Technology should serve as an aid and not a substitute for the embodied experience. Having said that, I also want to point out that I see myself and I see you as a discipler of disciples. fact, we even have an institute of intellectual discipleship here. But I want to modify that just a little bit and suggest that we are disciplers not just of head and heart, but also of body. That is to say that there are important not only intellectual and cognitive aspects to learning, but also embodied practices in learning. And we shape those embodied practices both by what we do in the classroom and what we ask students to do outside the classroom. So education that's deserving of the name is a form of discipleship, and discipleship as an embodied relationship. The famous pastor and martyr Dietrich Bonhoeffer has a wonderful expression that I ran across the other day in his works. He says, God does not want the word to be proclaimed by phonograph records, but rather by witnesses. And it seems to me that we could extend that not only to the proclamation of the word, but the proclamation or exposition, as Tom put it, of mathematics or English or pharmacy or nursing. That is to say that we not only that we are witnesses of our discipline, therefore disciplers of our disciplines, and not just another conduit for communication. The classic view of education and the role of education has been that of producing good citizens for the polis. I think that our responsibility, our obligation in a Christian institution is to see Christian higher education not only as preparation of good citizens for the polis, but also preparation of good citizens for the kingdom. And so I think our responsibility is much more holistic, and that requires that, I'm thankful for this opportunity to participate on this panel for this reason. It requires that we think critically about the application of technology in the delivery of education and not just be early adopters of every new technology that comes down the pike.
Thank you, Ben. I'll go to Sharon Evans, also the face of the UTEC conference.
Every time I've heard Ben say that comment about being technologically Amish, I think of my first experience ever of seeing an Amish person. I walked into the barn, the old barn that was the gift shop, and the Amish man standing behind the counter was watching a television, watching Saved by the Bell. So I definitely know that the Amish are not against technology. I will speak about technology from the perspective of nursing faculty, as well as give you some of my own personal experiences. I think the School of Nursing and nursing in itself is very dichotomous in nature when it comes to its use of technology. Simulation is one of the most important aspects of teaching nursing. The hospital is a very high-tech environment, and it's a high-tech environment that we as faculty use in simulation lab to do things like speak through a hidden microphone in the mannequin to our students, so that we can improvise the situation, make it as realistic as possible, or do things like use the mannequin to actually hit the vein to draw blood, and blood actually comes out, or with our anesthesia students, have them intubate a patient and actually put them on a ventilator, a mannequin patient, that is. This is a vital part of our teaching with our students that the School of Nursing could not move forward without. It's expected to be competitive. Our traditional programs and our nurse anesthesia program cannot and never will be completely online because we're people dealing with people. The students need to have their human interactions as well as their skills monitored by faculty members in both the simulation and the hospital environments in order to ensure that socialization occurs, that professional behavior, that compassion, the accurate performance of the skills techniques at minimum, and for us to make sure that they are learning and growing and walking in the love of Christ. On the other hand, many of our graduate classes and most of our RN to BSN classes are online classes. These students are already nurses. So in order to be attractive to these nurses who are working, we needed to have online classes to allow them to continue to work and continue their education. Also, in order for the traditional students to be competitive in the work environment, they need those computer skills associated with the online environment. We need them to type words, not LOL. So our traditional students take several non-clinical classes online. Initially, personally, I was opposed to doing online nursing classes in any of the nursing courses of any type. Due to circumstances at the state university where I was teaching, in other words, the dean mandated it, I was told to move the class I was teaching to the online environment or I'd lose that class. Now, it was a class that I dearly loved to teach, ethics in nursing. So I did it. I moved to the online nursing environment and have been teaching online courses now for 10 years. And have grown to see the benefits and the possibilities of it. Of course, during that time, technology, as you know, has markedly improved. And the ways that we can now interact, and I want to draw your attention to that word, I think interaction between the faculty member and the student in the online environment is key. So with our online students and this interaction, these improvements in technology, we can continue to improve. I think another key component of that, though, in order for the interaction to occur, is to keep the classes to an appropriate size. I think especially with our calling here at Union, I think we can teach with excellence and integrate Christian faith in the online environment through that medium. I think it's also something that we absolutely need to do. When I have my 9-year-old nephew over and see him working on his iPad and hear him telling me about the classes that he has on his iPad in grade school, I'm going, we have to do this. Also in the School of Nursing, we're doing some blended style courses throughout our different programs. In other words, some work live, some online. I'm perhaps most excited about this style of class because of the experience I had this past fall with my students where I flipped a classroom for the first time. It was, again, that course that I love so much, teaching legal ethical aspects of nursing. In case you are not aware, flipping a classroom, at least what I did with this group, was I actually recorded my lectures ahead of time, did voiceover PowerPoint, so it appears to them as a PowerPoint video with my audio voice moving the slides forward. The students listened to those lectures before they came to class. The thing that I love about this is that it essentially moves almost all classroom time beyond the taxonomic knowledge level. You automatically are in, at minimum, you know, application comprehension, if not higher. The students, I'm told, raved about this experience to the nursing administration, so it was a very successful experience, I would say. Any live class can do this, and if you want to know how, you will have to come to UTech Expo. Shameless plug. Actually, Dr. Armstrong is going to be doing a didactic portion on teaching integrity lecture capture at the expo, and then I will be doing a hands-on in our speed geeking session, so please come and learn. And the other thing that I'll say about that, even if you don't want to do it consistently, is it's an absolutely wonderful thing to have for, it is the end of February, ice and snow days, or days that you are sick. So, thank you.
Okay, next up we have Gavin Richardson.
I'll go ahead and begin this morning with an anecdote, and I didn't make this up, I promise, for this session, but it works out nicely. Sunday night I was watching television. I had DVR'd Doctor Who, so I was watching my Doctor Who. And my 14-year-old high school freshman son was in the room as well, doing his biology homework. And at some point, I look over at him on the couch doing his biology homework with Doctor Who on. But he has his earbuds in, and he has his school-issued iPad there running YouTube, a music video, which is what student-issued iPads are for. And he's reading his biology homework. So we've got two screens and some audio that he could hear. And so I gesticulated wildly, trying to get his attention, and then asked him to pull out an earbud. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm doing my biology homework." It sounded just like that, actually. And I said, "How are you processing anything that you read when you're, you know, you have all this stuff going on?" And he looked at me like I was crazy, and he said, "You know, the words are right. He said the information is right there. I got to do is just find it." And it, you know, occurred to me that he was reading the text in much the way that we might skim a Wikipedia article looking for a date, right? He was just trying to find a nugget of information to put on a piece of paper, but there's no higher order cogitation going on. He's not really processing anything, and I just, you know, shrugged my shoulders and said, "You know, you're going to have to develop better study habits and reading habits before you get to college. You know, you're not going to read Jacques Derrida with, you know, YouTube and Doctor Who going on, although that might actually help if you've ever read Derrida." But he, you know, put his earbud back in and went back to the business of ignoring me. You know, we see these, I suspect that that's probably a lot of the way our students read. And in this information age, when we have so much going on, you know, we can't watch a basketball game on ESPN without a crawler at the bottom, you know, telling us what the other scores are, you know. And that used to really bother me. Now I've just sort of gotten used to it. But we've gotten really good about multitasking, and our students have gotten really good about skilled at multitasking. But I don't think either one of us monotasks very well anymore. And by monotask, I mean sitting and looking at a text without any embedded link to click on for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes. I'm not sure the last time I did that, right? And this is not necessarily to set this problem at the feet of technology. I think it's just a broader cultural reality of where we are today in the 21st century. But, you know, we've seen those billboards about, you know, distracted driving, all right, texting while driving, and now, you know, the word's getting out about distracted driving. I think there needs to be, if not billboards, some posters around campus about distracted reading, because I don't think our students know how to read very well anymore. And the way that we engage texts is changing dramatically in ways not seen since, I think, the 15th century shift from vellum to parchment or to paper. What we call a text is changing. And rather than being some kind of neo-Luddite and running away screaming about this, I think we have to figure out how to face these changes, particularly when it comes to texts and what it means to read. In my World Lit class, every semester I begin with this big spiel about how to read and how you're supposed to, make annotations in the margins and write little summaries at the top. We cover a lot of pages, and this is how you read with a mind awake. I said even the highlight pens are limited in that they just change the color of the page. They don't really, 3 weeks from now, you're going to look back and say, oh, that page is pink, and it used to be white, and I'm not sure what that means or what that signifies. But I was thinking, at what point will all the textbooks not be physical, and what point will all the textbooks be virtual, on iPads and tablets and what have you? And some disciplines may have already gone to that already. And where does that lecture go then about, annotating texts? And so I spent this morning, as I thought about this presentation, I spent this morning looking at iAnnotate or various annotation apps, sort of educating myself about those kinds of things. And I was talking with Hunter Baker. He was talking about, taking notes on a Kindle, and sometimes if you highlight, it will upload to the cloud or somewhere. The annotation, or what you highlight, right? So that at the end you can print out your annotations, so that I think we can make a virtue of necessity here as the nature of the text shifts. But we're going to have to be pretty intentional about guiding our students about the best practices regarding reading, i.e., no Doctor Who, no Kanye West, just you and a text, that would be ideal. And I also think we need to maybe educate ourselves. I know I do. About ways in which we could still have students engage deeply a text, even if it's not a paper text. And I don't think I've been very good about that, and I think I need to get up to speed about it, because I think this is this change is happening, right? And as a side note, and this is maybe my vox clamantis, voice crying out in the wilderness, I do think we have a... I think this shift to the virtual text may, in the short term, have eroded a kind of respect for the text in general. I don't know if you've perceived this or not. But, in the 15th century, if you had a book, an animal had to die. Something had to bleed. You had to, you had to prepare the parchment. You had to spend weeks, months, days inking it. And when I have my students do this, they say that the words on the page mean more. The words on the page meant more to them because they had to work for them. Now, when we can get millions of words on something like this, do we have a culture that has a little contempt for the text? And how do we fight against that when the words don't mean as much as they used to? And that's something that I think we're going to have to continue to negotiate as a culture.
Thank you. Before I pass on to Andrew, did you just say that you have the students kill an animal to make a book?
We can't order the bell, and we have somebody else take care of the
Okay, all right. Andrew Tiger is next.
Thanks. I want to start off thanking Dean Roseborough for his thoughts. I think my goal in the classroom is to create disciples, but I'm talking about disciples of my discipline. I want them to fall in love with the material, the things that I like to do, and I think when you do that, I think that the learning comes also if you can teach them to love what you love. The question the questions given, the one that I want to address is how can someone who cannot come to campus, how do they still learn? And I've had to do research in this area. My previous institution, we were heavily encouraged also to offer programs online. We offered the management program online, which included the business core as well as the management courses to get a degree. And to do that, we certainly had to incorporate some new technologies that I hadn't used before. But we also had to assess. We had to, for accreditation purposes, we had to prove learning. One of our tools that we used was the major field test in business, a standardized test. And so we looked at a six-year period and looked at students who were online students versus face-to-face and used some analysis and couldn't see any differences in the results. So at least from a standardized test standpoint, I think I have evidence that in the management curriculum that learning was occurring. I taught in that. I taught what I teach is throw in math and computer models at business problems. That's what I do. And it was a challenge to how am I going to teach that in an online course. And I've heard people mention, and the things that I relied on heavily were professor-developed videos. Not videos with the textbook, but videos that I developed that was specific. It was 5 to 10 minute videos. The software that I used at the time was Adobe Captivate. I think that we have Tegrity, is that what it's called here, that I've used a little bit. But I have a library of these videos, you know, and they're 5 to 10 minute at the top. They're specific to a certain thing, how to do. But I could also use those videos to praise or to scold if I had test results and tests or problems that I needed to address. You know, the only bad thing about it, it was my voice. You know, I'd like to get Charlton Heston or James Earl Jones, but it was Andy Tiger's voice. But I think there's even a side benefit of that. I had these students. They also were on campus, and they got to at least hear me. It was screen capturing software, so it was model building that they could follow. I could add notes to it. Says, hey, pay attention right here. It was a player. They had a player that they could stop and rewind and watch it as often as they want. Again, 5 to 10 minutes. It allowed them off-site to upload quicker than some of these a longer lecture. So that was the tools that I used for when I taught online. The other thing I want to address is certainly there are metrics out there that measure learning that aren't measured with the standardized test, and I think there are some that are not learning measures, but important measures that I think we need to address if we're teaching online courses. Commitment to university, loyalty to the school. I'm doing some work with Landon Preston where we're looking at our students giving back to Union. We looked specifically at undergrad students here over the last 7 years and looked at that and looked at, did they have online courses or not? So one of the things that we used as control variables was things that we'd already found in literature. If you live on campus, if you're part of student organizations, you give money back. There wasn't anything done, though, as a function of, well, did they take online courses and they're ready to give money back? What do they remember? Are they going to give money back? And we just looked at likelihood of giving back, not quantity, because we're only looking at 7 years or so. But we did see a slight drop. We saw it was significant, but there was a drop in the likelihood of giving back. So I think that's something we have to address. And if again, that's not necessarily a learning thing, but again, a love of university, commitment to the university. There are things that we can do, I think. I think one of the research papers that we looked at was that PhD programs, we looked at success of cohorts of PhD programs, and there was more success when there was high student-to-student strong relationships. Not necessarily student-to-teacher, but student-to-student. And when that there was a strong relationship there was more success in terms of graduating from their PhD programs. I think that's things that we can manage and proactively do in the classroom. Again, I think these videos add some personalization as well.
Thank you, Andrew. Just a few comments from me. What I would say is very much influenced by Dr. Roseborough, some interactions that I've had with him. You know, the first thing, when you were talking about making videos, I started thinking about how if you read USA Today or something like that, you know, the columnist always has the little picture. And you've been reading the same guy for 20 years, and his picture has never changed. And I think about the online videos, you know, Andrew may be, you know, 60 years old or something. They're still looking at the videos of 40-year-old Andrew.
I was a good-looking 20 years.
Yeah. Okay. I want to begin with kind of a proposition, which has already been stated by a few people, which is that education is not just about delivering content. And Dr. Roseborough, I think, put it, education is not a presentation. So it's not just about the content. If education were just about the content, before we started, Gene Fant, or maybe at the beginning, Gene Fant was talking about a book as a technology. When we first started to have the kind of funds to have really great public libraries in some of the big cities, that would have been a mortal threat to the university. Because you could just go in the library and learn all you want.
and educate yourself. Of course, that hasn't been the case. And I think about it, particularly a movie scene. I bet that a lot of you have seen Good Will Hunting, the movie that made Matt Damon and Ben Affleck into big stars. And in that film, there's a scene in a bar. I guess the bar is near Harvard. And Ben Affleck is Matt Damon's dumb friend. It might be the reverse in real life. But but in any case, Ben Affleck is getting sort of intellectual sand kicked in his face by a smart Harvard guy at the bar. And Matt Damon, who is a young genius, comes over and, you know, kind of angrily confronts the Harvard guy and shows his superior knowledge because, you know, Matt Damon's character has like a 200 IQ or something like that. And in particular, his devastating line is that, you know, you're paying, you know, $100,000 to go to Harvard. Meanwhile, I got all the education you got for a $2 library card, right? You know. Of course, there are some problems with this scene. For instance, the assumption is it's just sort of a battle between what he can get at the public library and what the other guy can get at the library in Harvard or something. This takes no account of the value of the faculty of Harvard, right? You know, essentially, the faculty at Harvard count for nothing. You know, I may agree with William F. Buckley. I would never want to be governed by the faculty of Harvard, but I do not think that they have no educational skills. In fact, this caused me to think about basically professors are, and this is corporate speak, they're a value-added part of the educational process. That's what professors are. I mean, we add value. If we don't add value, there's no point in us being involved, but we do add value. And I thought about my graduate program at Baylor had this European style reading year, you know, where you go off by yourself and you read for a year and you come back and you are examined upon what you have done. And I was thinking about that, and you know, on the surface, you would think, well, you're just doing it all yourself. You're teaching yourself during the reading year. But that's actually not true. What happened in the reading year is that I consulted with four different professors. They each gave me an extensive list of readings, books, and articles. So they had the knowledge of what it is that I should be reading, right? I mean, it's the very opposite of the just kind of find whatever you can find online and learn it. I had experts in the field telling me, Hunter, these are the books and articles that you need to read in order to really understand this, right? And then at the end, these were the people who had the expertise to examine me upon whether I had actually learned. They were the ones who would know whether I had actually learned. So they're really bringing something substantial to the table. It wasn't just about the books that I read. It was about what the professors had done. And if you want to go beyond that, of course, I had been in the graduate program for a couple of years before we had the reading year, and they were teaching me what I needed to know in order to be able to read those books and articles. That without them, I mean, in many ways, it's as if I had to learn French in order to, you know, I had to learn about the language and the culture of France in order to read books in French. They taught me what I needed to know and understand about my subject area, which was religion and politics, in order to be able to fruitfully spend a year, you know, not a bad year, not a year where I'm kind of reading it while listening to a YouTube video and got Doctor Who on, right? You know, but to spend a productive year reading those books and then be able to be examined both in terms of an oral examination and a written examination on what I had learned. So that's just to make clear, you know, professors matter. And I think that this kind of goes along with what we are learning. You know, what technology is going to do very successfully is cause us to rethink what we do. for instance, one of the things that I used to aspire to, you know, and I still do, but is kind of to write columns in newspapers. You know, it used to be a big deal that that certain people, David Broder or whoever, wrote a column in the newspaper, a regular column. But something has happened to punditry, thanks to the explosion of the internet and blogs and Facebook and everything else. Punditry has become incredibly cheap, right? You know, there's a million people with a million opinions, and you can read the ones you want anywhere. When I first started writing online, they paid some very good fees, and it just went down, 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 because, you know, there's a lot of people offering it for free. For us, that function, the thing that is becoming cheap, is just delivering content. If you're just kind of standing there, you know, kind of just sharing face value what's in a book, and you're not really adding anything to it, then you're engaged in kind of that cheap process. And what we have to do is to do the things that are much richer. And again, this is what Dr. Roseborough is pointing to. What we have to do is we have to bring value in terms of knowing what to study, knowing what to read, giving the students feedback. I mean, what becomes so much more important, I think, is the feedback process, to react to what students say, to react to the comments they make, the way that we answer their specific questions, to encourage them to formulate and ask questions, the way we grade their papers and their tests, the way we design the tests, all of those things, those are much, much more kind of high-value added processes than just the content delivery portion of it. And by the way, this vision of instruction, it doesn't really square that well with the MOOC. And I don't know if anybody actually – I think that the MOOC is Massive Online Open Course, right? I may have the two O's reversed. But, yeah, of course, the idea that you have a course where 400,000 people are following via YouTube, and yes, you can deliver content that way. And you may even be able to do some rudimentary testing. But a lot of this other stuff that we're talking about in terms of the high-value activities, you cannot perform those through a MOOC, and those things will not be supplanted by Coursera open courseware. Another thing, traditional, this is kind of a Ben Mitchell point, except stated in a more boring way. Traditional embodied education is also important for some very prosaic reasons. I mean, for example, a lot of times online education, you know, you see the billboards driving down the highway. You've got the student sitting cross-legged on the floor in the pajamas and the bunny slippers, watching some kind of course unfold on their laptop computer. And, you know, it made me think, in a lot of ways, education, the way we do it here on campus, this is a proxy for work. Part of what students demonstrate to employers, I mean, you know, college in a lot of ways is kind of a shortcut signifier for employers that you can do certain things. For instance, that you can wake up in the morning. Yeah, you can. Now, some students don't do this, but you can. You can wake up in the morning. You can get yourself dressed. You can show up somewhere at a specified time. You can receive an assignment. You can complete an assignment. You know, these are all work type activities. And again, you know, this is less well done oftentimes in the online environment. I'm at the 1 minute. Okay. Let me just say this. The technology is blossoming at a time when there is tremendous price pressure on what we do. The warning I want to give is that if we just find a way to use technology to make it cheap, I think we will damage higher education. For example, I went to Florida State back in the late 80s, and in some ways they were trying to cut costs, so they would put 500 of us in an auditorium for a biology class, which was ridiculous, right? You know, I didn't learn anything. That was an effort to sort of offer a lot of education, make it cheap, but it didn't work. If that's the way we approach technology, it's not going to be successful. However, if we if we find ways to use the tool to really improve the way we interact with the students, to improve the way we offer them content. We can use it to make content compelling sometimes, but the key is just to continue to focus on that. What is the, you know, what difference do I make? What difference do I as the professor make in the classroom and out of the classroom with the student? I think that's the key to dealing successfully with technology.
Following the panel, Dr. Jean Fant, Union's Executive Vice President for Academic Administration, provided some concluding remarks.
I appreciate the panelists preparing their thoughts and reflecting and being vulnerable with us all. And I don't want to belabor our time a ton, but I just want to make a couple of quick observations just as we conclude. One of the things that I'm really hopeful will be a result of these conversations today is that we will think of technology as a tool and not as a threat, because I think one of the problems that we've got right now, not institutionally, but in terms of our higher ed, academe, is that we're thinking of technology just as a threat instead of as a tool. But I will say this as a word of warning: if we don't think of it as a tool, it will be a threat. Because I can tell you, as a father of two 14-year-old ninth graders, they think completely, the way that their brain cells work is different from the way my brain cells work. And watching that play out is just very stark for me. I had a professor when I was in doctoral work who said, by the time you're 40, you need to be out of the classroom and into administration. He didn't mean me, he meant anyone. Because he said, you forget what it feels like not to know anymore. And I thought that was a really interesting observation. I really disagree with that observation. You know, by the time you finish your doctorate, you've only got 10 years left, you know, or less. But what was really behind that was just this idea that at some point we have the temptation, as professors, we have the temptation to stop learning. I had the professor for church history when I was at New Orleans Seminary who taught my father. And I could pull my father's notebook out and use that notebook in class. And I loved that professor. He was the dearest man. But he had ceased learning. And maybe he thought nothing new had happened in church history and therefore, you know, it was all good. But there was still something that happened there. And I'm afraid maybe what happened there was that he had lost the love for his discipline. You know, when the scriptures tell us that we need to be called back to our first love, obviously it's talking about Christ. But if we are to be professors, professional professors of our disciplines, we need to find ways to stay in love with our disciplines. I love my wife. I pursued my wife when we were dating. I was afraid somebody else was going to get there before me. And so I pursued her, and I put flowers on her windshield, and I wrote her poems. I did everything I could to pursue her. But if that's all that I had done after 20 years of marriage, it would not be a good place. And I'm afraid that that's where a lot of us find ourselves. We see these things as threats. We see these things as time consumers. We see all these other things. But what I'd like to do is just urge us all to be reminded that these are merely ways for us to pursue our students, to pursue our disciplines. Heard a professor one time say something that I think is absolutely true. He said, 90% of your students are there to pay your salary. The other 10% of the students could never, ever compensate you for what you've done for them. And I think there's a lot of truth in that, and that is particularly true if we love our students. And is that not the essence of the Christian ethic? And that's all we get throughout the New Testament, is that we are to be motivated by love. And we are paid to love our disciplines and paid to love our students. And the distinctiveness of a place like Union is that we are in a community where we teach students to love God through their callings. Isn't that an amazing opportunity? And so where technology enables us to do that, it's an amazing tool for us to be able to do that. And so my final word of encouragement to you all today as we start the semester, we're still a little fresh. We still have a little energy because we've just had our break. But my big just parting comment to you all is, remember, you love your discipline. You love your students. You love God. What better calling could there be for us? And consider technology through those lenses and how it can help you to pursue your students out of that sense of love.
This has been the Focus on Education podcast. Visit uu.edu/centers/edpractice to learn more about the Center for Educational Practice and Union University's School of Education.